Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a La Liga end-of-season special on the Gegenpod. La Liga TV's Phil Kitromilidis joins me, your host Teo Pelizzeri, as we go from top to tail on the 2022-23 season. The six-way relegation battle, Barcelona claiming the title, what's next for Real Madrid, and plenty more. It's all coming up as we talk all things Spanish football and La Liga right here on the Optus Sport Football Podcast. Let's get in to the Gegenpod. It is a La Liga special to end the season, and our favourite from La Liga TV, Phil Kitromilidis, joins us. Phil, it's so great to have you back on the Gegenpod.
Thank you very much for having me. We've got lots to talk about, haven't we?
We certainly do, and I want to start with what I was doing at 5 a.m. on Monday morning here in Australia. Of course, it was prime time in Spain, and that was the five-way relegation battle. Our Optus Sport viewers got to enjoy the whip-around coverage with all the goals as they went in and all the big incidents. It was a fascinating final day. How did you experience it and take it in, and what was your experience of the five crucial games at once?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was quite historic. I don't think we've ever had so many teams that could go down on the final day. You say it was a five-way. It was, with five different games. Six different teams being able to go down on the final day of the season. That is genuinely historic. That's never happened before, and it might not ever happen again. So it was very, very exciting. And then the games itself, some were more exciting than others. Everything hinged on that Valladolid-Getafe game, because if Getafe had beaten Valladolid, Valladolid would go down and everybody else was safe, but they didn't. And that game stayed 0-0 for the whole 96 minutes or so, which meant that everybody else was looking over their shoulders. And it was also interesting because all six teams knew if we win, we're safe. All we have to do is win this game and we're safe. But I don't think any of them managed to win the games. I don't think any of them managed to win. So it was a very, very tight, and everybody sort of looking over their shoulders and checking other results. And that's how we want it to be on the final day of the season. We didn't have much of a title race in La Liga this season, but we did have one of the most dramatic relegation battles. And yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
We certainly did. And you mentioned Valladolid. They were the one team and the one game that stood still while we had all sorts of twists and turns going on at all of the other venues. So what did it say that they couldn't do enough on the final day to control their own destiny, to try to win, but ultimately they had to settle for that nil-all draw?
Teo, they were at home. It was a packed house, 25,000 at the Estadio José Zorrilla. All they needed to do was beat Getafe to stay up, and they didn't manage a single shot on goal. And I think the fact that they went down with a whimper, Valladolid, they went down with a whimper. It wasn't that, you know, they tried everything and they threw the kitchen sink at Getafe, but they just couldn't find a way through. It was a really disappointing end to the season. And I think that's why a lot of Valladolid fans are very sort of despondent about how they were relegated. I think their very high-profile president in Ronaldo Nazario is also extremely disappointed with how they went down. And when you go down, knowing that all you have to do is win against a fellow struggler, and you don't manage a single shot on target in 96 minutes, then you know you can't have too many complaints. They do have complaints, because a lot of teams do have complaints about the referees this season, but let's not get onto the referees, Teo, because we could be here all day. A lot of teams have question marks about refereeing in La Liga this season. Valladolid have gone down, and you know what? I think they probably deserve it.
Well, I wanted to ask, because all the teams had destiny in their own control, and is that a vote of confidence for head-to-head results being used instead of goal difference? Is that something that's an annual debate in Spain? Because, of course, in the Premier League, for example, it's goal difference. In Spain, it's head-to-head. Is this something that perhaps, is a debate that should take place a bit more?
Not really, actually. I think everyone's pretty used to it being being the head-to-head here rather than goal difference. If anything, it's people from outside coming into the league and getting to know the league and realizing that, oh, hold on a second, it's not goal difference, it's head-to-head, and it's more of a surprise to them. But here in Spain, nobody's really suggesting that it should be goal difference instead of head-to-head. And actually, if you think about it, maybe the head-to-head, is it fairer? I mean, two teams, you know, who decides, you know, decide how they stay up? Well, maybe the actual games between those two teams, who's a better team, who's been better this season, maybe head-to-head, I think. I quite like it, actually. Obviously, I raised in London, raised on the Premier League, but coming here, been here for the last 11, 12 years, and I've gotten used to it, and I actually quite like it. So, yeah, I haven't got a problem. Where it is problematic is that it gets complicated. So if there's more than one team level on points, then they go into sort of a mini-league, and it's the points that they've accrued in matches between them, between all different teams, that determines who's staying up. And there was one scenario where we could have had five teams ending on 41 points. Five teams. And then you have to go and see the individual results between each one of those teams and see who's picked up the most number of points. And yeah, then it would have got really, really, really complicated. But I actually quite like it.
Well, let's just briefly say goodbye to the three relegated teams. And I'd like to ask you, what does La Liga lose? Because having edited the mini matches and highlights for a number of La Liga games for Optus through the course of the season, I really like Gonzalo Plata. I'm sad to see him go along with Valladolid. As you say, the rest of the team couldn't actually lay a glove, couldn't get a shot on goal in their final game, and down they go, but with 11 wins and 40 points. But what do we lose from each of the three relegated teams, Valladolid, Espanyol and Elche?
There are some players that have gone down that you might not be missing for too long, because I'm sure there will be teams that will be potentially looking at Gonzalo Plata and other players like him and trying to keep him in La Liga. But yeah, in terms of the three individual teams, listen, Elche, Espanyol and Valladolid went down. Of those three, Espanyol are by far and away the biggest club. Espanyol are seventh on the all-time points list in La Liga. This is a big club. This is a historic club. This is a club that is usually in La Liga. So you lose a big fan base. You lose the Barcelona derby, which is, okay, it's more important to Espanyol than it is to Barcelona necessarily. But this season, Espanyol got a point at the Camp Nou. They're a side that really gets up for their games against Barcelona and always takes it to the to them. And yeah, I think Espanyol are, you know, one of the big, I don't want to say sleeping giants, but it's a team from a big city with a big fan base, a decent stadium, and they should not be in the second division, and they have not been in the second division for the majority of the last three decades. Elche and Valladolid are also historic clubs. This was Elche's centenary year, and they really did not expect to be celebrating it with a relegation. And Valladolid as well are from a relatively big city with a decent fan base. This was their record number of season tickets that they'd sold in one season. I think it was around 22,000-23,000. So good support there. But in terms of sort of selling La Liga to an international market and getting people really hooked on it, I wouldn't say that Valladolid and Elche are necessarily clubs that are going to be vital to that. But I think Espanyol, the league will miss them. Big club, the derby with Barcelona, some strong players as well. So yeah, I think they're quite a big miss.
And just briefly, La Liga Smart Bank, of course, our Optusport audience does get one feature game a week, and we're currently in the playoffs. So tell us about the two teams that are already coming up to La Liga, and then maybe your pick for who will be the third to join them.
So we've got Granada and Las Palmas who are coming up. Granada, who got relegated last season on the final day of the season, actually. They were outsiders to go down, but they did. And they've come straight back up. They won the title. A very, 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 very tight Liga Smart Bank, it has to be said. There were four or five teams who could win it on the coming into the last couple of weeks, and it ended up being Granada. And Las Palmas are back in after a few years away. So good to have teams from, I like to see all of Spain represented, and Las Palmas are from the Canary Islands, which are an archipelago of of islands just off the coast of Africa, a 2.5 hour flight from Madrid. So it's quite far away, but it's nice to have all of Spanish territory represented in La Liga. So good to have a Canarian team in there with some nice players, actually. And now we've got the playoffs. We're midway through the semi-finals, and Levante beat Albacete 3-1, so I think it's pretty safe to assume that they'll be in the final. And then it's either Alaves or Eibar. They drew 1-1 in the first leg. I think Alaves are going to make it through. So if we're looking at Levante or Alaves, two sides that were in La Liga last season and are looking to come back immediately, I think logic dictates it's Levante, because they played Alaves twice in the regular season and beat them 2-0 twice. So logic would dictate that they've got the beating of them this season, but it's the playoffs. Anything can happen. But yeah, if you're asking me to predict who's coming up there, and I think you are, I would say Levante, but with the caveat that it is the playoffs and strange things tend to happen.
No, well, we will take that on notice. Now, before we move up to the top end of the table, I have one more on the relegation battle just finished, and that is, who was perhaps the luckiest team to survive the drop? And if it is the same team, or maybe a different team, who has the most work to do in the off-season to avoid falling into the bottom three?
Valencia. I mean, Valencia have the most work to do in the off-season to get to where they need to be. Valencia are such a massive club. I mean, it's hard to sort of make people who don't live in Spain understand what a big sporting entity they are, but they are absolutely huge, an enormous, demanding fan base who are used to seeing this team be successful. Valencia finished 16th this season. They've only ever finished 16th once, as low as that, in their 104-year history, and that was the only time they were relegated in 1986. This is not a team that is involved in relegation battles. This is a big European club. And they finished 29 points off the Champions League spot, so they've got an absolutely enormous, enormous task at hand to try and get back where this club should be. I say they were lucky to survive the drop. I think they were quite lucky to survive the drop. Lucky, and maybe give credit to the manager, Ruben Baraja, who decided, you know what, I'm going to give the kids a chance. I'm going to give youth a chance. And he brought in players like Javi Guerra, like Alberto Mari, and like Diego Lopez from the youth academy, who all scored really important goals. And without those goals, Valencia would have been relegated. So I guess you can call it luck for the manager to take a gamble on these kids and it pay off. Or maybe we should give him some credit and he saw things where other people didn't necessarily see. But Valencia have got a massive, massive job on their hands to get back where they need to be. They were close to going down. They were very, very close to going down. They didn't. And there was a big relief, I think, amongst the fan base on Sunday evening or Monday morning, not Australian time, when they didn't go down. And then there was the sort of slow realization that, whew, okay, we're safe, but we finished 16th. This can't happen again. It can't happen again for Valencia. So yeah, they have massive, massive work to do in the summer to make sure that they're not involved in this ludicrous relegation battle. They should be absolutely nowhere near this.
Well, watch this space. We'll see if they can make the moves or if the turmoil will drag into another campaign. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of turmoil dragging into another campaign, let's talk about our champions, Barcelona. Of course, nice, it was a runaway title win in the end. 10 points clear, so arm's length, and obviously a goal difference of plus 50. Only conceded 20 for the entire campaign. A lot to like about their league form, but put it in a broader context for us as to where the club is at, because it's not just about the league, it's about the financial situation, it's about how they went in Europe. I mean, we can certainly celebrate them, though, for what they achieved over the 38 games in La Liga.
Yeah, and those stats you said would have been even better had they not won the league so convincingly. So, you know, they finished 10 points ahead of Real Madrid, they finished with 20 goals conceded. Had they not won the league with four games to spare, they would have won more games and conceded fewer goals. They lost three of the last four games because they'd basically, you know, we're champions, we don't really need to try. So those stats would have been even better as it is. Still very, very impressive considering that last season they finished 13 points behind Real Madrid. So it's a 23-point swing in their favour. And massive credit to Xavi Hernandez and what he's achieved. That said, last summer was pretty tumultuous for Barcelona. All the economic levers that were pulled, there were signings made, a lot of money was spent. Big gamble from Joan Laporta, the president, investing money now to bring success now, but also forfeiting future financial gain by selling off assets now. So he's gambled. And at the moment, it's paid off because they won the league. Fine, good. Now, next season, they have to improve in Europe, because really, it was massively, massively disappointing to go out at the group stages of the Champions League once again. I mean, this is unheard of. When Messi was there, that would be absolutely unthinkable. But it's happened a couple of times now, and it really can't for Barcelona, not least because of their image, but also economically. You know, you can't be going out of the Champions League if you're trying to rebuild this brand. So there is work to do. There's work to be done within the La Liga financial fair play restraints, which is what is, I don't want to say holding them back, because I think it's a good thing that there is financial fair play in La Liga, but it's what's making things more difficult for them. It's what's making the return of Lionel Messi potentially quite tricky as well. But I think it's going to be another fascinating summer for Barcelona, because they have to bring people in. Xavi said, you know, we need to strengthen. We genuinely need to strengthen. But they're also going to have to let some players go. It's true. Busquets is off the wage bill. Jordi Alba is off the wage bill. This, you know, they sold Antoine Griezmann as well, so he's no longer there. So that was their last season. So they have gotten some people off the wage bill and reduced them, but they need to do more. They need to do more if they're going to be able to register and give new deals to players that need new deals, like Ronald Araujo, like, you know, Gavi. And then go into the transfer market and splash some cash. So there's loads of work to be done off the field this summer for Barca again.
How much of this, though, is balancing the books of the wages and the players that come and go, and how much they're paid and their contracts and how much they're renewed for? And how much of this is at the mercy of what assets or economic levers the club can still pull? Are there, you know, buildings, territory, assets, intellectual properties that Barcelona can imagine and then monetize in order to assist the football operation?
I'm not sure how much is left. I mean, they did sell off quite a lot last summer, so I think they'd be trying to avoid that where possible. And this summer, focusing on, as you said, restructuring the squad and balancing the wages, which is obviously very, very important. Like I said, they've got, you know, Jordi Alba was on a massive, massive wage, and he's left for the final year of his contract, so that will help. Busquets the same. Gerard Piqué obviously left earlier this season as well, so that will help Barcelona hugely. But yeah, they've still got work to do in balancing the books. I don't think there's too much left for them to sell off in terms of levers. They're cutting costs as well. They closed their TV channel, Barca TV, ceased to exist. It was 110, 120 people employed there. No longer. So they're cutting costs on that kind of level as well. Oh, and all this is happening, Teo, while next season they're going to be playing at the Olympic Stadium, while the renovations happen to the Camp Nou as well. So they're sort of fighting fires on all fronts. It's a very, very busy time for Barcelona, and it's going to be for a while, I think.
Well, tell us how much stock we can put in the daily reports that Leo Messi wants to come back to Barcelona. Obviously, the global media, I only speak English. I don't have the advantage of being able to read Spanish like you do. How much different is the reporting in Spain and close to the scene, as opposed to what the world media is feeding out about the daily suggestion that Leo Messi wants to come back?
I'll tell you the suggestions or the feeling that I get from you know, listening and reading to all the stuff here in Spanish. It feels like both sides are trying to show like they did all they could for Messi to come back to Barcelona, but it wasn't quite possible in the end. I'm not saying it's that they're putting on a sort of show or something, but at the same time I find it difficult to believe that this is seriously, genuinely going to happen. And I think it might be in everyone's interest for them to say, oh, you see, well, we tried to make it happen, but it just wasn't possible. And so Messi can go off and make a lot of money elsewhere, and Barcelona can continue to sort of rebuild without him and without needing to restructure things financially to accommodate him. So that's the feeling I'm getting from what I'm seeing and from what I'm reading. It just feels very difficult for him to return. There are just so many obstacles, and I'm not sure if it's worth it for Barcelona. Genuinely, it seems a ridiculous thing to say. Obviously, Lionel Messi, possibly the greatest player of all time. If you can get him, you bring him back into your team, right? Maybe not. Maybe not. You've moved on. You've moved on from him. You've just won the league. To bring back 35, 36-year-old Messi now and try and shoehorn him into this team at the expense of younger players and their potential development, I don't know. It doesn't feel like the right move footballing-wise. Maybe off the pitch, it would help things quite a lot for Barcelona. But in terms of football, it doesn't necessarily seem like the right decision.
And then last one on Barcelona, who is top of the shopping list then? Because any player in the world would love to be linked to them. I see a couple of World Cup stars like Randall Colomwani from Eintracht Frankfurt or Sofyan Amrabat from Fiorentina, some of the latest names to be attached to a potential Barcelona move. But with your insights, who do you actually think is a realistic target that we might see pull on their colours for next season?
Anyone who is cheap, Theo. Anyone who is cheap who can come here without a big...
Yes, but I'm cheap. I won't help them.
I don't know. You could do a job at right back, maybe. It's difficult because it's difficult to sort of reconcile this notion of Barcelona being a huge club and them spending all this money on transfers last summer and then this summer thinking, actually, we don't really have that much money to spend on transfers. And if anyone's going to come in, it's got to be someone cheap and ideally free. I think Inigo Martinez is coming, the centre-back from Athletic Club. They've been strongly linked with him. He's said goodbye to Athletic Club, I think it was yesterday, so he's definitely leaving there. He hasn't announced where he's going, but he was strongly linked with Barcelona, and he's a free agent. They're looking at free agents. Ilkay Gundogan, as you mentioned, you know, someone like Sofyan Amrabat could come in. But we're not talking about major, huge superstars or the outlay that they had last summer when they spent $60 million on Rafinha, brought in Robert Lewandowski, etc., etc. That's not going to happen again.
Let's talk about Real Madrid now, and perhaps the burning question that needs to be resolved before their off-season can even start is, what is the future of Don Carlo Ancelotti? Has Real Madrid set a deadline for him to commit to next season and say, I am back, we are building, and actually put an end to the speculation about the Brazil national team, something which has lingered for months and has never really gone away?
I think now it kind of has gone away, and I think, yeah, Ancelotti is going to be here next season. He's said that. Maybe it took a little bit too long to come out and publicly fully declare that he was going to be here next season. But yeah, I think Ancelotti is going to be here next season. They're working towards what they can do and what they can rebuild, because there is going to be a bit of a rebuild for Real Madrid. A lot of players have left, are leaving, not least Karim Benzema, which requires significant restructuring of the squad, and one that they didn't necessarily envisage. I think this blindsided quite a few people. So yeah, Carlo Ancelotti is going to be there next season, and he is going to be at the helm of trying to fit someone into Karim Benzema's boots, which is not going to be easy.
Well, handling that generational change, I assume then that Carlo Ancelotti is the right man to do so. Karim Benzema has been announced in Saudi Arabia just this morning, Australian time. So he was always leaving and the farewells had been conducted, but now his next move is known. But how do you think the other veterans of this team will be handled by Carlo Ancelotti from here?
Well, he's always been very loyal to his close players, and there have been quite a few question marks from Real Madrid fans this season when he kept playing Toni Kroos, kept playing Luka Modric in midfield, but he believes in them, and both of those players are going to be here next season. So we'll see Toni Kroos and Luka Modric in midfield again next season, surely not as much, and particularly Luka Modric, who's going to be 38 and played a lot of football this season. Okay, admittedly less than the previous season, but still played a lot of football. He surely has to begin to understand that he won't be starting every game. At least we think not, Theo, because I thought that this season, and then when the big games came, bam, Luka Modric, centre of midfield, and actually still showing that he's got it. He's someone who looks after himself extraordinarily well. He's completely dedicated to football, completely obsessed by football, watches loads of football at home as well. He's someone who genuinely loves the game. So Modric will keep going as long as possible and as long as Ancelotti keeps playing him. But I think there is broadly speaking, a general understanding that this season there does have to be, or next season there does have to be, a generational change, particularly in midfield, with Modric and Kroos a year older and the likes of Tchouaméni, the likes of Camavinga. We think Dani Ceballos might stay. Fede Valverde is there as well. There are youngsters there who are definitely able to be important for Real Madrid. I'm not going to say they're going to be able to replace Kroos and Modric, because I think they're two of the best midfielders of all time, but they're certainly well placed, Real Madrid in midfield, to handle that change when it comes.
Give us a heat check on Jude Bellingham's move, likely versus unlikely, soon versus not so soon. Obviously the transfer fee, Dortmund are going to look to cash in as best they can. Is that the big domino that has to drop before Real Madrid's other transfer business of the off-season can take place?
The heat map is that, Jude Bellingham has long since been a really, really, really strong transfer target for Real Madrid. I was told about a year ago, that they were going to do everything in their power to sign him this summer. And it looks like it's going to happen sooner rather than later. But this Benzema thing, when I say it's blindsided people, this wasn't in the script for Real Madrid. They thought they'd have Benzema for at least one more year, and then next summer try and get that French lad from PSG who they quite wanted and thought they had, and then didn't end up signing. So Mbappe in 2024 was the plan. But now, obviously, they've got to try and find a replacement for Karim Benzema, which could well be Harry Kane. He's certainly a player that Carlo Ancelotti thinks is capable of trying to replace a striker who is almost unique in Karim Benzema. In his own words, Benzema, I'm a number 9 with the soul of a number 10. So he wasn't just all about scoring goals. He wasn't just about being in the penalty area. He could do all that, but he also did so much more. The dropping deep, the linking up, the passing, the runs, and something that Harry Kane is pretty adept at doing as well. So I think Kane is viewed as the best possible replacement for Karim Benzema within the club. The problem is, we have to mention the L word being Daniel Levy, who Real Madrid are particularly wary of doing business with once again. They've done it before with Modric, they've done it before with Gareth Bale, and they are aware that he drives a hard bargain and he will try and get as much money as possible for his number one asset. That being said, 1 year left on his contract. Don't want to sell to an English club, so Real Madrid might be a good option. The option of Harry Kane coming to Real Madrid is actually growing stronger and stronger. Real Madrid have liked Harry Kane for a while. When they played Spurs in the Champions League, I think it was it about 2018, the two board, the president and these chief exec of Real Madrid, Florentino Perez and José Ángel Sánchez, they had lunch with Daniel Levy, and they asked Daniel Levy, quite like Harry Kane, he's pretty decent. And they were quoted £225 million then by Daniel Levy. So he's older, but he's got a lot more goals under his belt now. He's proved himself for a number of seasons. So I'm not sure what kind of price Daniel Levy will be quoting to Real Madrid. That's why they're wary. But yeah, Kane to Real Madrid is a distinct possibility if they can sort out the negotiations.
Well, of course, as you would know, Spurs have just hired an Australian, Ange Postecoglou, as well, giving that Kane, will-he-won't-he discussion significant amping up, not just for Spurs fans, but for all Australian football fans, as we see how Ange Postecoglou handles the situation. One thing that was suggested on an earlier edition of the Gegenpod this week by Mark Schwarzer was that Kane's transfer fee in pure dollars or euros might be frightening, but what about a player swap? Is there anyone that Real Madrid might be able to hang out in front of Spurs to try and sweeten the deal and maybe reduce the literal amount of cash they would have to fork out in order to acquire Harry Kane?
I saw a suggestion a couple of weeks ago that they might be tempted to try and include Eden Hazard as part of the deal, which I think would maybe be the worst deal in history, because Eden Hazard is not the player that he... that he was. Anyway, he is no longer a Real Madrid player. They have parted ways with him a year early, so there won't be any deal there. I don't know. I don't know who they could include, to be honest, because the squad is a little bit thin now. I mean, Marco Asensio's gone, Eden Hazard's gone, Karim Benzema's gone. In terms of forwards, there's no one that they could really drop in. I mean, maybe they might try and include a defender, possibly Ferland Mendy at left back, a French international left back who's been injured this season, but some suggestions that he could be included as part of a swap deal. But I'm not sure that they have actually too many people at their disposal that they'd be willing to let go and would actually interest Spurs as well. I'm sitting here looking at the Real Madrid squad, and to be honest, not too many of them are, that the ones that they've currently got are surplus to requirements, and the ones that they are wouldn't necessarily interest Spurs too much. So off the top of my head, maybe Mendy, but other than that, I'm not too many, I don't think.
Just on Eden Hazard and the end of his time at Real Madrid, obviously had a great reputation from both Chelsea and also his performances for the Belgian national team. How do you assess his time in La Liga? And as far as the perhaps biggest misfires, where does he rank, especially when you weight it for the amount of money that was spent both on his transfer fee and on wages?
Yeah, I mean, the wages, yeah. You know what, the transfer fee, I don't think it wasn't a bad deal for Real Madrid. It was actually a pretty good deal. Okay, he had 1 year left of his contract, but they got an elite, maybe top five player in the world when he signed. He was 28, just come off the back of an unbelievable World Cup with Belgium, just had been unbelievable for Chelsea, and they spent 100 million euros on him. Okay, some people say it might have been elevated to quite a bit more than that, but the fee was officially around 100 million euros. That deal, it's not a bad deal for Real Madrid. What subsequently happened has made it into one of the most disappointing transfers of all time, which is why I don't want to use the word, you know, worst transfers, because like I say, the actual deal itself wasn't bad. I don't think it was, you know, wildly overpaid like Philippe Coutinho, for example, when they signed him from Liverpool, Barcelona. I think that was a bit too... This was different. This was an absolutely elite player for 100 million euros. It made sense. And he just thought, genuinely, his career fell off a cliff. He is only 32. He's only 32. And at the end, he was just an irrelevance. I genuinely sometimes forgot he still played for Real Madrid. That's how little he was involved. And yes, he had injuries. Yes, he didn't necessarily, and he didn't look after himself physically as he should. And it just all spiraled out of control. He was here for four seasons. He didn't ever play a Clásico. He didn't play one Clásico against Barcelona. They played Barcelona 12 times during the times. He didn't ever play in a Clásico. He was here for 4 years. They signed him for 100 million euros. Eden Hazard, one of the best players in the world. It's just a staggeringly disappointing transfer and one of the most disappointing transfers in La Liga history, and possibly anywhere, really, because given where he was when he came and where he is now when he's finishing, and there are suggestions he might retire, Teo. There are suggestions that he might just leave football age 32 because he doesn't really have any offers. And I think he's clearly fallen out of love in the game with what's gone on here. And there are suggestions that he could retire. So, yeah, it's one of the most disappointing transfers I can remember that has happened ever in any league. And it's a shame that for me, obviously, it happened here, because when he arrived, we were, you know, doing backflips. It was so exciting. What an incredible transfer to have here in La Liga. And we didn't see any of it. Any of what made him so special for Chelsea and for Belgium, never saw it once here.
Do you think the tell-all, where he gives the insights as to why, is coming? I mean, I can't help but think of, on a lesser scale in terms of the money, Antonio Cassano and his various off-field struggles and ability to mentally engage with what it took to be a professional. But Hazard's highs are so much, all due respect, so much higher than any peaks that Cassano reached. It's extraordinary that it makes the fall even more precipitous.
Listen, I would read that book. If it comes out, I'm ready to read that book, because I would love to know what's gone on behind the scenes, because obviously stuff has gone on. You don't get to where he is now from where he was without, you know, it's not just injuries. Let's put it like that, because he has had injuries. He has missed quite a lot of games through injury, but it's not just that. So, yeah, if there's a book, if there's a documentary, if there's a film, I would watch it. I would read it, because I would love to know.
Now, you mentioned the Clásico and Eden Hazard never taking part in one. But when we think of the Clásico, for about a decade, and it has slowly been chipped away over recent seasons, it was Benzema, Bale and Cristiano for Real Madrid, and Messi, Suarez and Neymar for for Barcelona, and with Karim Benzema's departure, they're all gone from La Liga. And the great times of those front threes, the great El Clasicos, the great title races, they are finished. And how does it leave you feeling about both what we got to enjoy, but also maybe what needs to step into the void and fill those great high-profile identity players that really defined the two clubs for a generation?
Well, we need them to sign some players with surnames that neatly fit into a sort of three-letter abbreviation. So, I mean, Real Madrid, they've got Rodrigo, they've got Vinicius, you know, we've got RV, VR, or maybe someone else. I don't know. You're right.
Edric, it can be REV. They can be the Rev team. I don't know.
There you go. REV. I like it. I like it. Yeah, Endrick's coming next year when he's, you know, when he comes of age. So let's see what happens with that. But yeah, I mean, it is a bit nostalgic, and maybe we didn't realize at the time what we were being treated to, and I don't know if we took it for granted, but we're looking at two unbelievable attacking tridents, which in their heyday were really quite extraordinary to see come up against each other, and you know, we might not see anything like that again in European football for a while. As you said, you know, six extremely, extremely high quality players coming up against each other. It was pretty special. So yeah, nostalgic, but always looking forward, and always looking forward to seeing what happens. But in terms of getting a group of those kind of players, one side Real Madrid, one side Barcelona, coming up against each other, fighting for titles like that again, maybe we won't see it quite at that level.
Stay with us here on the Gegenpod when we come back from this short break. We'll talk about Sevilla and also other Spanish teams in Europe and the prospects for how they might go next season.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back to the Gegenpod. We've got La Liga TV's Phil Kitromilidis joining us. And Phil, let's talk about Sevilla, because they won the trophy with which they have had such an extraordinary love affair, the Europa League. They did it in a pretty incredible final. A lot of people didn't enjoy the final as a spectacle. I must admit, I kind of did. When they held up 11 minutes of stoppage time, I was just having fun at that point. And then the penalty shootout win against Roma and the subsequent meltdown of Jose Mourinho after that. But what were your impressions on Sevilla doing it once again in Europe, given that they had such a difficult La Liga campaign?
Yeah, the final was quite a spectacle, wasn't it? And not necessarily from a Football League angle. 26 minutes of injury time across the whole game. It was pretty wild. Sevilla were in the relegation zone in January. This was not supposed to happen, and yet it was almost inevitable in the way it happened. And I think I don't want to sort of always bring this back to the big guns, and I'm wary of drawing the parallel with Real Madrid. But what Real Madrid did last season in the Champions League was so ridiculous and so unexpected. You know, beating the teams that they beat in the way that they beat them. I think Sevilla did something similar in the Europa League. And, you know, these are two sides that have particular affinities with those two competitions. And Sevilla, this is their competition, winning it for a seventh time in a season when they were fighting relegation for half of the season, to then go and to beat Juventus and to beat Manchester United and to beat Roma in the way they did, and Jose Mourinho in the final. It's really quite extraordinary. I don't say it defies all logic, because there was hard work done by Mendilibar when he came in. But there is something as well, that intangible sprinkling of magic, if you like, which football has, and which we saw last season with Real Madrid in the Champions League, which I think we saw a little bit with Sevilla as well. So Mendilibar came in, and they were so bad that he himself said, it's not going to take too much for me to change them, because this is a good group of players. They were just very, very low on confidence. They were confused. Jorge Sampaoli had them trying to do things which they didn't necessarily understand or want to do. And José Luis Mendilibar simplified things. And got it right. Rode his luck a little bit in La Liga, it's true. Got some good results, got some late goals, got a dodgy penalty, I think, in Bilbao. Anyway, they got some results that helped them build confidence, build momentum. They rode their luck in Europe as well, though. They were 2-0 down at Old Trafford. They had been absolutely dominated by Manchester United. In the last 5 minutes, they scored two of the most ridiculous goals, two wild own goals to get them back in the tie. And then they go and, you know, thrash United 3-0 in Seville. I mean, that was, like I said, it's like that intangible feeling that this team in this competition, special things happen. And we see it with Real Madrid last season particularly, and we saw it with Sevilla this season.
What's realistic for next season then? Monchi still at the helm. Mendilibar, I assume, is now keeping his job and no more managerial turnover. But do we say they aim for the top four, they aim to get out of their Champions League group, or do they need to set their sights a little bit lower and just make sure that they're not battling relegation again halfway through next season?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, them battling relegation was not something that anybody had expected and anybody foresaw, and it's not acceptable for a club of Sevilla's stature and fan base. So, no, obviously, they will need to rebuild and come back and try and fight for top four. That's where Sevilla need to be every single season. I mean, they ended up finishing 12th, to be honest, because they didn't win any of their last four games, but they were very much focusing on Europe. But 12th is a really, really poor season, staggeringly poor season for Sevilla. I think it's their lowest this century, to put it into context. So had they not won the Europa League, it would have been a very, very different matter. But they did. They're into the Champions League and things look very, very different. Mendilibar is continuing. Monchi is the one who might not be there next season. Yesterday, there was a story here in Spain that said that he's taking a few days to assess his future because this has been such a draining season. And the full weight of the fans' ire and the blame and the press were placed at his door when the season started so poorly for him. And he got it wrong in the summer. He did all sorts of deals that didn't work. And he just about pulled it off in January by bringing in some players that helped and improved the side. But it was an utterly exhausting and draining season for Monchi. So he, at the moment, at the time of recording, is reportedly considering whether or not he wants to go again next season. Spoiler alert, I think he probably will. But because it was such a exhausting and emotionally draining season, he needs some time to think about it. But Sevilla are a side with squad, with budget, with capacity to be fighting for the top four. And they absolutely should be aiming for that next season. Relegation, they flirted with it. They should be absolutely nowhere near the bottom half of the table, let alone the bottom three.
Well, speaking of exhaustion, when we last spoke to you on the Gegenpod, we were discussing Diego Simeone and potential burnout at Atletico Madrid. They did correct course. They did qualify for the Champions League. Can we assume that it is now business as usual for Atletico Madrid, or do you think those issues that plagued them in the first half of the season may resurface if they think everything is just good to go to reset for another campaign?
I don't want to be simplistic about this, but there is perhaps a coincidence that things started to turn around for Atletico Madrid when João Félix went on loan to Chelsea. Okay, it's not all down to him, obviously, but maybe there is something to be said in that as well. The dressing room was calmer, the team started to play, and they had an extremely good second half of the season. If they had that kind of form in the first half of the season, they'd be challenging for the title instead of finishing 11 points off. So they were really, really impressive in the second half of the season. It helped that Antoine Griezmann could play every game as well. There was that ludicrous contractual issue at the start of the season when he could only play 30 minutes. So when you've got your best player being able to play all game, every game, that also helps. And João Félix is a problem. He's back. Manager doesn't really want him. The club would love to try and sell him, but are not going to get anywhere near the 125 million euros that they spent on him. So they've got this asset which has devalued enormously. They would have loved for his loan deal at Chelsea to gone very well, but it didn't. So he's back and he is a problem. And I'm not sure what Simeone is going to do with him. Maybe another loan, because Simeone isn't going anywhere. There were suggestions earlier on in the season that it was either João Félix or Simeone. Well, obviously, the manager won. He's going to be there next season. And let's see how they figure it out. But they have to improve in Europe, because they went out of a really, 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 really winnable Champions League group. It's not that they didn't, they finished bottom. They finished bottom, and it was Bayer Leverkusen, Porto and Bruges. I mean, with all due respect to those three fine sporting institutions, Atletico Madrid should be winning that group pretty comfortably, and they finished bottom. It was a catastrophe in Europe for Atletico Madrid, and that has to improve next season.
Now, the race for the top four, it didn't have the most compelling finish, but up until about game 33 or 34, it was a fairly torrid tussle between four or five teams. And in the end, Real Sociedad separated themselves from the chasing pack. So what can we expect from them in the Champions League next season? And are they in a position to push any closer to the title race, or have they hit their ceiling as things currently stand?
I think title race, no. And also, I'm a little bit sceptical as to how this squad can manage Champions League football and La Liga next season. It's a pretty young squad. Not too many of them will have had too much Champions League experience. Real Sociedad haven't been in the Champions League for 10 years, so it's a big deal for them. And we'll see how much they invest in the squad to go and really sort of go again and try and make sure that they, if not make themselves the fourth force in Spanish football, try and be regulars in the Champions League. That fourth spot in Spain, it feels like it is a little bit up for grabs. I mean, Villarreal have been there in the last few years. Real Sociedad, Betis, Sevilla, Valencia traditionally, but they've been nowhere there. So in terms of that fourth spot next season, it's going to be open again, and it depends on who does what in the transfer market. I think it will be difficult for Real Sociedad to compete in the Champions League and to compete as they did this season as well. They had monstrously bad injury problems through a huge swathes of the campaign. They sometimes had 8, 9, 10 players out, and what they did is they brought youngsters in from the youth academy. Mentioned them in my season wrap article for Optus, and it's quite extraordinary. 27 outfield players have played for Real Sociedad this season. 18 of them have come through the youth academy at Real Sociedad. 13 of them are local lads from the province where Real Sociedad plays. So they've used the youth academy very, very well. It's got them to fourth in La Liga in a very open league where fourth spot was wide open. Is that going to be enough for them to push in the Champions League and push further up in the league? I can't see it myself. I can't see it. I think it's going to be difficult next season. I'd love to be wrong. But I think it's going to be tough for them.
And if I can get your thoughts on the other European qualifiers, Osasuna, who made the Conference League, Villarreal in the Europa League, and a team that, particularly in the first half of the season, I always hoped that I got assigned to edit their games, Real Betis. I really enjoyed watching their games, particularly in the first half of the year, though, before their form became a little bit more shaky. Is it an inevitability that we'll see a Spanish team in the final or on the dais in the Europa League or Conference League next season with the quality of teams that have qualified at, notwithstanding, of course, that anyone that finishes third in their Champions League group might end up there as well?
I mean, you know, we need to see what Sevilla do in their Champions League group, because if they finish third, we all know what's going to happen in the Europa League. But we like Osasuna, right? Because of, you know, John Aloisi and all that. And it's great to see Osasuna back in Europe, 16 years after their last continental adventure. They've deserved it as well. It's a really it's a likable club with what they've done. The stadium is fantastic. There's a real communion between the fans and the players there that you don't necessarily get in other stadiums. And the manager has worked wonders as well. So it feels like a good fit as well, the Conference League. They'll take it seriously. They'll be up for it. And they'll be a match for anyone in that competition, particularly at home. Betis, I was disappointed by Betis. But yeah, you're right. First half of the season, they were playing some nice stuff. They've got some extremely talented players. Sergio Canales, Nabil Fekir, William Carvalho, Guido Rodriguez. They're, you know, seriously good players. Second half of the season, I felt they lost their heads quite a bit. They had 15 red cards, Teo. 15 red cards this season. It's more than any team in any major league in Europe. And yeah, okay, there's a conversation to be had about the officiating in Spain in general and the number of red cards that were shown, which was far, far more than in any other league. But still, Betis getting 15 is ridiculous. And also, they commit the second lowest number of fouls per game in La Liga. So we're talking about them losing their heads. They're not sort of wild challenge. They're not consistent fouls. They're not. This is just them not knowing how to manage matches, which is strange considering that they're managed by Manuel Pellegrini, who is a manager known as the engineer, who likes to control and be calm and be able to see off these kind of situations. But I felt that Betis lost their heads and missed out on quite an actual good chance of finishing in the top four. And then Villarreal, they pushed Real Sociedad. They were the last ones that were in with a shout of finishing fourth. They had a difficult season because they lost Unai Emery. It's difficult when you lose a manager and you're doing all right. It's not like they changed manager because they were struggling. They were doing okay. He'd had great success in Europe in the previous seasons. And then Aston Villa came and they had to completely rechange things. And in came Quique Setién, a different kind of manager with a very clear and different style of playing football. And that took a while to adapt to. So I think fifth is not a bad finish at all for Villarreal. But yeah, I was a bit disappointed about Betis. And Betis actually, they played Manchester United in the Europa League and they rested players for that game because they were trying to push for the top four in La Liga. And I was thinking, well, if you're going to get into Europe, at least take it seriously, at least against Manchester United as well. And it just felt like, I don't know, the whole of Betis' second half of the season was quite disappointing to me because they had the squad there, they have the project, the manager, the fan base to be, you know, really doing something quite impressive, and they just sort of tailed away from me.
So let's take a quick look at what might be coming up in the off-season. We did discuss the changes of teams, promotion and relegation. We have discussed the transfer prospects of Barcelona and also Real Madrid. But is there anything else that we need to keep an eye on or that you might have flagged? I did notice that Gabri Vega, when he was subbed off after scoring both the goals for Celta against Barcelona, was incredibly emotional, the 21-year-old, because the speculation was it was his final game. But is there an obvious landing spot, or is his landing spot already known, and is there anyone else on the move either into or out of La Liga that we need to keep an eye on?
Gabri Vega was very strongly linked with Real Madrid earlier on in the season, but those rumours have cooled as the Jude Bellingham transfer has become more concrete. So Gabri Vega is now being linked with Chelsea. I would love him just to stay at Celta, stay a little bit longer. He's had one really, really good season. And actually, if you push me, he's had two-thirds of a really good season, because the last few games, maybe 10 games or so, he hasn't been at his best. And that was perhaps one of the reasons why Celta Vigo were in the relegation battle. So I think it's maybe a bit early for a £35 million move to Chelsea for Gabri Vega after, you know, two-thirds of a good season. But who knows? Nobody listens to me. But yeah, Gabri Vega could be on his way out. I'm loath to try and sort of highlight talent from La Liga, which might be pinched by the Premier League, because it seems to happen every single summer. But yeah, there's loads of great players here, and I just hope that they stay here.
Well, Phil, the floor's yours for sort of the final word on the season, because there are some topics that we haven't got to as part of this chat. Obviously, we've really focused on what happened on the final day and on the pitch. But I mean, you also said, you know, a couple of times you made mention of the refereeing situation and the number of red cards. Of course, you know, Barcelona's off-field financial struggles, the various issues around fan behaviour and racist fan behaviour in La Liga this season. There has been a full roller coaster of things that have gone on in La Liga over the course of the season. But if I was to give you the final word for our Gegenpod audience, what impressions and sort of what lasting memories, but also lessons, did the season leave with you?
Yeah, I think lessons might be a good word. I think the racism debate which has been sparked by the racist abuse received by Vinicius actually feels like it could be a turning point, not just in, I don't want to get too deep here, not just in Spanish football though, but potentially in Spanish society as well. It's sparked conversations I've had it with Spanish friends. You're talking about things that people haven't necessarily spoken about before. Why is this offensive? Why can't we say this? What's the difference between just insulting someone and then racially insulting them as well? These kind of things which haven't necessarily been highlighted before in sort of common society, with, you know, friends talking to people are talking about that now more. I'm not going to say that this is some huge revolution and everything's going to change. No, there's a long, long, long way to go, and it's going to take time. But I have been heartened in the couple of weeks since it happened about some of the conversations that I've had on a personal level with people, and I feel like it might be the start of something. Like I said, there's a long, long way to go, but hopefully people will begin to realise more in Spain what is just completely unacceptable. Because honestly, I've been living here for 12 years and I've seen and heard a lot of things that I have genuinely been upset by and staggered how it can just go unchallenged. And I'm not just talking about people on the streets. I'm not just talking about people that I know on TV, in the press, on the radio as well. You hear things that are just ingrained into everyday language and sort of society that it's just not acceptable. So if people start questioning it a little bit more, and if people start calling it out as well, which is what Vinicius did, he went over to the fan, he pointed at him and said, "You are doing this to me." If people are calling it out more, then hopefully that's the start of it not being normalised. And yeah, so I think that's, you know, for me, it's something that's very, very important. It's an issue that's very, very close to my heart. We've tried to cover it on the content that I've done for Opta Sport over the season, and it's something that we'll keep focusing on because it is seriously important. And sport is there for us to enjoy ourselves and forget about serious things in life, but also it can be used as sort of an impact to a catalyst for things. And I genuinely feel like this might be a catalyst, even though it might take a long time. So yeah, there we go. That's my final thoughts on that matter. For this season, it's not my final thoughts, though, on it ever, because I'm sure we're going to come back to it at some point.
Well, Phil, it's been incredible to have you on our screens on Optus Sport, both with La Liga TV, but also the paper round and your writing and what you've contributed to Optus Sport throughout the course of the season. The off-season can't go quickly enough, so we can get back to our Sunday mornings and Monday mornings, and quite often Friday mornings too, enjoying La Liga action. Thank you for joining us on the Gegenpod once again. Enjoy the off-season, and if that does involve a break, enjoy the break. Otherwise, we look forward to seeing you back on La Liga TV very, very shortly.
Yeah, I hope I get a little break, Theo. Just a little one, and then we'll be back. Thank you very much.
Yes, a big thanks to Phil Kitromelidis. What a sensational season we have had of La Liga on Optus Sport. Don't forget, there's still live football going on. The J-League and K-League seasons continue. See broadcast details on the Optus Sport website and app. And it is a double drop of the Gegenpod this week, with a special edition focused on Ange Postecoglou's appointment to Tottenham Hotspur. You can join me, former Premier League stars Mark Schwarzer and Michael Bridges, and former Socceroo Tommy Orr, as we go in-depth on this groundbreaking moment in Australian sport. So don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and rate us 5 stars while you're there. We will be back for a special edition of the Gegenpod straight after the conclusion of the Champions League final. So make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it. That's it for this edition, though. I've been your host, Teo Pellizzeri. This was the Optus Sport Football Podcast. Thanks for listening to the Gegenpod.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.